Hello, and welcome back to a new episode of For the Love of Weather. This is the podcast where we explore the Earth's atmosphere and how we are all connected through weather and climate. We are your hosts, Gemma and Aisling, both meteorologists and weather presenters, and have been working in weather now for over 15 years. If you're new to the podcast, we are so thrilled to have you here with us. And if you're coming back to us, thank you so much for your company again. And as always, we hope you leave this episode loving the weather just that little bit more and learn a little something about how weather and climate can impact our daily lives and the amazing changes that we can make. I'm meteorologist Aisling.
Hi, and I'm Gemma, and we are so pleased to welcome Georgina Gilbert and Rebecca Openshaw-Rowe, aka the Antarctic Fire Angels, to the podcast. Georgina and Rebecca are both firefighters, and if that wasn't even awesome enough, they also, in January 2024, completed their incredible Antarctic expedition where they skied unsupported from the Union Glacier to the South Pole, a dream and vision that had been 4 years in the making and something they hope would inspire women and girls to achieve their ambitions. Not only are they the first emergency services team to traverse Antarctica, but they are also pioneered a new route where they went from Union Glacier to Constellation Inlet and then on to the South Pole. A journey that took them 52 days, 10 hours, and 30 minutes and covered an incredible 1,230 kilometres. They are now planning and building the Fire Angel Foundation, which will see female fire cadets and girl guides embark on a 3-month program, culminating in a mini expedition in Sweden where they will build self-esteem, confidence, and learn to support each other during times of adversity. Georgina and Rebecca are two truly awesome and inspiring women, and we are really excited and lucky to have them on the podcast today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for
Welcome,
having us.
welcome. So we always start our podcast by asking our guests where their love of what they do comes from. So we'd like to ask you, firstly, why did you both become firefighters? And then also, why did you then go on to take this incredible expedition?
I became a firefighter because it was the only role open way back in the day. That all the girls do the same as the boys, basically. So it was inevitable that I was always going to join something in a uniform. But yeah, it was the only service where the girls do exactly the same as the boys. And now I'd like to say the boys do exactly the same as the girls.
And I joined the fire service. I was quite late into the job, so I didn't join till I was 37. So I was a teacher and did a lot of sport before that. But I had a lot of friends in the fire service, and it'd always been something that I the a job that I'd kind of been aware of, but never just had the chance to kind of get involved. And then I think it got to a point where I was kind of looking at my life and thinking, do I want to stay in teaching? I was retiring from sport, and sort of teaching felt like it wasn't enough for me. And then I applied for the fire service and got in. And it's just I think for me it was just a job where no day is the same, and you get to help people. And I know that sounds really cheesy, but for me, I love helping people, interacting with the public, and having a challenge. And every day is different for us. So yeah, that's why I joined.
You're saying that you love helping people. Something that really struck me in the documentary I watched is that you mentioned about being a female support on site as well, and you're helping people in very difficult circumstances at times. Sometimes probably funny, sometimes not so funny, probably more often than not so funny. But how important it is to have a female on hand to provide some support.
100%. We go to people, and it's probably you it might be the worst day of their lives for them, and we're there to hopefully try and make that day slightly a bit better maybe. And I think like I was saying, the community is diverse, and I think to see for families and maybe women and stuff, to see another female coming to help can often they just I don't know I think they just I don't know feel a bit better because they've got someone a sister in the midst, just someone that's maybe got a bit more understanding of the situation for them personally than maybe a male counterpart might have. So yeah, I think it's really important that we're diverse in our workforce for that reason, so we're serving the community as a whole. And
But what's the ratio of men and women in the fire service? Is it equal? Is it anywhere close to being equal?
No. Yeah, percentage wise, I think across the UK we're at 11%, I think. Yeah.
If that, I think
If
it's
that.
9%.
Yeah, it's nine now, is it? Yeah. So, about
And
roughly
George,
9%.
you've been a firefighter for 25 years, is that right? Or 21
Coming up
years?
to 20, yeah, coming up to 26 years now,
So
yeah.
that ratio will have changed massively, I'm
Oh,
guessing.
tremendously. Yeah. I mean, when I first joined back in the day, we were at we were a course of 14, and four of us were women, which was unprecedented back then. But we made the whole service up to a total of five women back then. Yeah. And yeah, so you could imagine what it's like. It's quite a lonely place being the only woman, because we don't get to network with other women very often and things. So it can be good. The workplace can be quite lonely at times. But now it's great. It's greatly improved. Some services have better statistics than others, but across the board, it's still tremendously low. And it's not something that you can necessarily force either. It's just about early engagement. And getting kids at a younger age, and before you lose them, and basically they start doubting themselves. Young girls start doubting themselves. They don't see themselves represented, in particular roles. It's not just firefighting; it's other professions as well, engineering, STEM, all sorts. It's just about seeing themselves represented. So, unfortunately, we can we the last thing we want to do is start, the whole positive discrimination thing, which with the people got rid of that a long time ago now, because all what happened then is that the finger pointing, you only got this job because you're a girl, you only got this job, dot dot dot, and that's just the worst scenario for anybody to join any job. You get the job because you are good at it, so it's about early engagement for the majority, for me especially, and just convincing them and believing in them so they believe in themselves.
It's so interesting. So we talked to so many different people from different backgrounds, and actually one of our previous ones was someone who won the Golden Globe sailing around the world race, and she was female as well. And no matter who we talked to, actually somebody from Stansted Airport who was a female lead engineer, there's been so many people, including ourselves and Gemma, and we all say the exact same thing. If you don't see it, you won't be it. And like, we've like come a long way, even in our lifetime, in our careers, but I don't know whether social media kind of ruins it as well. Where you see, depending on what you start looking at, and then you don't see what you might or you could be,
I think we see on social media, we see a romanticized version of what you could be, and because people, either glorify it, or you don't you never you hardly ever see underplaying, or you hardly ever see normality. So we see a very romanticized version of all sorts of different careers, and I don't think that's terribly helpful. I mean, because you don't have to be, sorry boys, I know there's going to be boys listening to this, but where in terms of fire service, where an average man will get in, you have to be strength and fitness wise, now I'm talking, you have to be an above average woman. You have to be that just that little bit fitter and a little bit stronger, strength especially. And I think, we do see a lot of very, very positive and strong female role models on social media at the moment as well. But we also see a lot of other stuff going on social media that kids connect with because they think it's more trendy, because it's what their friends are looking at. So, but I mean, social media is here to stay. It ain't going nowhere, and we have to play it at its own game, really, and do amazing stuff ourselves and try and attract attention and go, look at us, this is what we do. We love our job and we're doing it because we love it, and for no other reason apart from being humanitarians, and we want more women in the job because it's a damn lonely place.
Speaking of amazing things, and hopefully they do see all this on social media, but my goodness. So you go to a conference and hear somebody speak and think to yourself, that sounds cool. And then you do it 4 years later and you manage to get best to go along with you. Tell us the story, like, how did that all evolve? At what point did everyone say yes? At what point did this feel like, oh my gosh, this is happening? And then it happened. And I have so many questions about when it actually happened. So just go for it.
Well, go on, Bex. Go on, you go for it.
Well, yeah, this is all George's fault. So when things were bad, you know, when we were having a tough day, I was very happy and smug to be, this is your fault, George, we're in this situation. But yeah, at the conference that George and I were both at the time, we didn't know each other at all. We just happened to be at this same Women in the Fire Service conference. It's run every year, a national conference. And so we were both listening to the same keynote speech. And, you know, I was like, wow, this looks amazing kind of thing. But George obviously took it one step further. And that's where the idea was born. So I don't know if you want to elaborate on that then, George, because you kind of brought it all together at the beginning, didn't you?
Yeah, so her name was Sophie Montague from the British Army, and she was part of the Ice Maidens. And yeah, she was keynote. So I went up to her in the bar later on. I said, look, you know, you don't know me, but 5 minutes of your time, is this something that a bunch of firefighters who can't ski do? Can we do this? And she was like, absolutely yes. Here's my phone number. Get in touch if you're serious. So I walked away, and I was so captivated by all the imagery that she was showing in her talk, and just what she was saying about women supporting women, showing women what women are capable of doing, everything, like, you know, believing in yourselves. I really, really connected with it. And yeah, so a week later, I got back in touch and I said, look, you know, can we meet up? Let's have a chat. And we did. She gave me all the phone numbers that I needed with the connections in the UK and abroad and further afield and stuff. And then just got the wheels in motion to form a team. So reached out, and then that was that. So we were a team of six to start off with. But through circumstances, injury, and then the last one was financial, that we didn't have enough for three, but we had enough for two to go and things. And different life pressures, and, you know, 4 years is a long time to spend, you know, in limbo, you know, with your family and your friends as well. Yeah, it just ended up just me and Bex going. So, and yeah, as Bex said, we didn't know each other nearly 5 years ago. And yeah, so it was quite a leap of faith to go in a pair like that. So, but because the parameters do change. So, you know, if one person gets ill, or, you know, it's very much on the other person to, you know, to toe the line, and vice versa, you know, so the dynamics were different, definitely, as opposed to a larger team. But having a larger team comes with its own politics anyway, doesn't it? And organizing it and stuff. So swings and roundabouts, really. So off we went, and we started training for it as quite a larger team, and it all got whittled down to just the two of us. So, and eventually, yeah, it's just myself and Bex that went off. We trotted on last November and haven't looked back since. It's just crazy.
I've often said in my life, so many things have started from just a conversation. Just a conversation, yeah. And somebody willing to give you a few moments of their time. And then you take the gauntlet and then you just run. And like, that's just so incredible. I do want to talk a little bit about your relationship, right? So obviously I only know from like social media and what we see in the documentary. But like, tell us a little bit more about how really hard that was, and like how you managed to like buoy each other up. And I know you were saying that you were worried about like all the sores on George's legs, but you didn't say anything. Like, how do you make that calculation? Like, tell us a little bit more from your point of view. What's that actually like?
Well, so George and I think, because we didn't know each other at all, We got to know each other through training, and we had trips away in Norway and Sweden throughout the 4 years, more towards the latter part of those 4 years, because COVID got in the way, which is a real scupper for us. And we tended, because we were, George and I were the oldest of the group at the time, so we tended to share a tent together anyway. And the girls aptly named our tent the Care Home. It's not very nice, is it?
I'm the oldest, by the way, by quite some way.
It just sounds like firefighter humour, you know?
Yeah, it is. And we just got on really well, you know. We're quite different in many ways, but we've got very similar humour, and we just worked really well together in terms of the routine that we had to have. And even when we were in a bigger team, We only had two people sharing a tent. So were you, even though you're in a big team, you worked in your little units then of two, when you would put the tent up, put it down, you know, all of, you know, looking after each other, the cooking and all of those kind of bits and bobs that you did around your day of skiing, you were doing in your unit as a pair. So we were quite lucky that we'd shared and spent a lot of time within that small unit anyway, which, you know, at the time we didn't know it would just be the two of us, but we were quite lucky that that happened. So I think when it came to just being the two of us, we kind of were, you know, it was a bit like, all right, okay, it's just us. There is nobody else to pick up the slack or help us out or be a buffer as well. You know, the, both having just two of you is very intense, but there's no one else around to talk to or be that buffer now and again. So, yeah, it was, I would say, you know, at times George and I definitely wanted to kill each other throughout the expedition. But I think the thing that really saved us and our friendship was the fact that we were able to tell each other, you know, if we were a bit annoyed with each other, which was most days, to be honest, we would have a little snip at each other is what we called it. But because we were able to do that and not dwell on it, and I think that was the biggest thing, because especially as females, we really do dwell on things if someone said something to you, don't they? But we managed to kind of just push it away, and then literally within a minute we'd be talking about something completely different and random, you know, to what we just had a little go at each other about. But it was great because we were able to get that off our chest every day, so then it never really built up into anything big, basically. But yeah, in terms of, you know, looking after each other, like I said, you know, we were really well drilled at the kind of the routine that we had to have to survive, and we had to do it every day, you know, to be really disciplined. And I think there, for George and I, there was never ever a conversation of, come on, you're not doing your role, you know, or you're not doing that job today. We were kind of like almost seamless with that, and almost kind of just knew, you know, we didn't really have to talk about it almost, and we would know if one of us needed to pick up a bit of slack from the other person or vice versa. Kind of just got on with it really. And yeah, and I think when George got her polar thigh, because she developed that in the second week, so really early on, so she had to carry that, you know, she had to deal with that for pretty much the whole expedition, and it would get worse and worse and worse every day. It got worse, and the sores that she could see, obviously she knew how bad they were getting, and was already having to deal with that mentally as well as the expedition, which was tough enough on its own. So I thought, I don't want to tell her that these other sores I can see are actually worse than the ones she can see. Because I thought, there's no point. As long as I'm keeping my eye on them and I'm telling her, right, you need to put this cream on, you need to put a dressing on now. But I'm not, you know, telling her exactly how bad they are. Then, but I know and I can keep my eye on them. Then I think, you know, we'll be fine. Because I suppose, selfishly for me, and it would have been for George, we could not have completed the expedition without each other. So if one of us had been really ill or injured or anything like that, then we both would have had to be evacuated. There wasn't one can leave and the other one can continue. That would have been the end of it for both of us. So, you know, we really had to work together. It was the ultimate kind of teamwork and partnership to get to that end goal and look after each other as best that we could, as well as, you know, looking after ourselves as well. So, but we did have good fun as well. You know, it was tough. It was really tough. The hardest thing I've ever done, and I think George, but we, you know, we also had good fun, and we've got a good sense of humour, and that definitely carried us through as well, I think. But yeah, George definitely wanted to stab me with a ski pole at many points during the expedition.
We're really glad she didn't.
Yeah,
do you know what,
yeah,
though? You sound like perfect sisters, you know?
Yeah, that's we say that our relationship is bickering sisters is what we are like, basically.
No. Yeah. I love the fact as well that when you was in the tents, you were watching a film. I really love the fact that you're watching a film where you was laying in the tents in Antarctica. But when you're actually walking day to day, are you listening to music? Are you listening to a podcast? Are you actually able to talk to each other? Because obviously you're one in front of each other. How does that work during the actual days?
Beck's listening to podcasts and different music and stuff, and she was having a whale of a time listening to different things. But then she'd update me in the tent what she'd learnt on her audio books and things about life and evolution and stuff like that. Yeah,
I did that. Yeah.
Today, what have you learned today? Tell me what you've learned today. Which is always quite funny. But I had a bash at listening to things like music and stuff like that. And my headphones were like hurting my ears, or they just kept popping out and stuff, and it was doing my nut in. And I thought, and my mic kept freezing up. And then, you know, 1 minute my music would be really quiet, and then it'd be like blasting in my ears, and I couldn't cope with it. So I was like, right, that's it, they're going. So I spent a couple of days trying that, but I spent the majority of the expedition just with my own terrible, terrible thoughts, and very strong in a monologue. So put it this way, I have quite a vivid imagination, and it's quite often I'd just be like sort of chortling away to myself behind Beck. So if I'm not concentrating on navigating, because when you're in front, you've got the compass mount in front of you, you're navigating, you're checking the GPS, and you've got quite a lot of stuff going on. But when you're behind, that's your rest time. And so I'd be like making up stories in my head and like chuckling away to myself. And then I'd share them with Bex, and she'd be like, "You what? You thought about what?" I was like, why wouldn't I be thinking what I'd wear when I get invited to the BAFTAs? And why wouldn't I be thinking who would I most want to sit next to when we get invited to the Royal Box at Wimbledon and stuff and things?
That's just so human, isn't it? Even in the most extreme of circumstances. Yeah. It's such a human...
Yeah, just human ponderings. It's
fascinating.
Oh, totally. And, you know, Bex would say that she'd end up like thinking about something that she did when she was a teenager. And she's like, well, why am I thinking about something I was a teenager? And I was like, well, no, well, I'm doing that too. I'm having completely and utterly random thoughts of stuff that I did when I was a kid that I've not thought about for years and years and years. Really random thoughts. Yeah.
That's quite like a spiritual journey as well, isn't it? It's not often in life that I know you're doing something quite serious, but I mean, for that space to become available in your brain to actually have some processing time for all of those memories to just, you know, come to life.
Yeah, I think on the good weather days, and when the ground wasn't too covered in sastrugi, so we weren't worried about falling over or breaking ourselves or anything else. You know, we were skiing for 10 to 12 hours a day. So it's a lot of time, and we're one behind each other. So you're on your own, really, in your own thoughts. And it's a lot of time to think over, you know, almost 53 days. It's a lot of time spent on your own in your own head. And yeah, you know, in normal life, you would rarely get many hours, let alone 53 days of it. So, yeah, I'm not surprised that we were thinking, you know, having memories coming back from many years ago. It was really interesting, wasn't it, George? You know, I was literally like, what? Why am I thinking about something that happened when I was a teenager? Honestly, I was like, I'd suddenly, you know, you'd be drifting into these thoughts and memories, and then you'd suddenly like come back into reality of where you were, thinking, why am I thinking about that? That's, you know, it's crazy. Yeah.
Quite cathartic by the sounds of it, though. I do want to talk to you about the Antarctic continent. Just, it's so fascinating. There's frozen water, there's frozen land, there's the South Pole, there's trying to navigate there. Who on earth came up with the idea to try and cross one of the ways that has never been crossed before? Who came up with that route? I mean, it's nuts. It's nuts.
Well, it's not as bad as you think. But yes, it was a quite heavily crevassed area, and we were like basically told, you do not stray outside of this box, kind of thing. the idea, Bex came up with the idea. Well, she came up with this because when this, it's quite prescriptive, the expeditions. And you actually, the more unusual they are, the more training you have to do to qualify for it, because you don't just rock up for an unguided and unsupported expedition. You do have to actually qualify for it. That's why these things take so long. So it was actually a combination of funding and, well, let's have a bash at doing this. So we actually didn't have the last few £1,000 coming in a bit slowly. So Bex came up with the idea of, well, why, said to our fixer, and our ALE fixer in Steve Jones, and basically said, well, can we not ski from Union Glacier? And he said, oh, well, that's never been done before. But you know, let me put it to the board. And he said, oh, why are you thinking that? And we were just like, well, we can't afford the flight to go from Union Glacier to the start of Hercules Inlet. And as it happens, it's worked out tremendously well, and we ended up pioneering a whole new route, and which had never been done before. And you know, opens up different routes for them as well. You're welcome, ALE, no problem. Yeah, so it opens up a different routes for them as well. Yeah, as random as it was, how it came about, yeah, it just happened. We didn't really intend on doing it. It was probably what, about a month before, do you reckon, Bex?
Yeah, it's about a month before, yeah.
Yeah, about a month before, Bex came up with the idea and said, you know, let's try and ski from Union Glacier down to Constellation Inlet. So the reason that, so no one skied from Union Glacier before. So the reason that we went to Constellation Inlet is so we could have a coastal start. So obviously it's like still miles and miles and miles and miles and miles of ice. So we could ski to a grounding line and then we could start what was ALE considering their official expedition from Constellation Inlet's grounding line. So, yeah, so that was their official start, really. So that's why we skied there. Otherwise, we could have sort of, you know, skied a slightly different way, you know, gone up a glacier first and then joined Hercules Inlet sooner. But no, we went down to the Constellation Inlet.
So that one's Beck's fault.
Yes.
Yeah, it was my fault. Yeah, and we were a little. It was a little bit nerve wracking. I must say that probably that first week, because that was the unknown area that we were skiing down. Because the route took us then up onto kind of the kind of normal routes that have been done a few times from sort of Hercules to the pole. But our first week was the real and unknown bit, and it was quite nerve wracking because it was unknown. And we've been given that they have a travel safety team, and they give you kind of a best fit safest route, which is all heavily crevassed. But they've done a lot of satellite imagery, so they can kind of see where the bad ones are, the big ones, etc., from years of data. But obviously, they don't have data from the year that you do it. So anything new that's opened up, they won't know unless someone's come across it or fallen down it. But I remember there was an area that we go down called the Gateway, and basically you really have to stay quite, I mean, we're talking a few kilometres, you know, a kilometre or so either side. But if you do get the navigation wrong on the compass, you will stray over a few kilometres wrong, you know, over the length of time that we were skiing for. And there was huge, 70 metres wide by at least 100 to 200 foot deep crevasses that we were skiing through, this huge crevasse field. And it was quite nerve-wracking, you know, even though we were sticking to the waypoints we'd been given to navigate through it safely. It was, and you could see them as well, couldn't you, George? You know, we'd look to the left, we'd look to the right where there was a big, you know, huge mountain ranges, and you could see these crevasses at the bottom of the mountain ranges glistening, sort of, they looked beautiful, you know, emerald looking, almost like swimming pools, you know, they looked lovely. It's like classic danger looks, it looks so pretty and shiny, let's move to the danger, and then you know, we're down the crevasse. But yeah, it was a little bit nerve-wracking, I think, some of those first few days, because we knew how heavily crevassed the area was, and no one had been down it on skis. So, you know, we were like, not sure what we're going to come across, almost, if
you don't have full appreciation for the crevassing, because they show you satellite imagery when you're planning and plotting your route and discussing it back at the headquarters. And you can see the satellite imagery, and when they zoom in, you can see the ripples, which is fine. But you don't get a full appreciation for the crevassing until you fly home over the top of them. And so we flew back from South Pole back to Union Glacier, and you can see ski tracks, you know, and you can see this rippling effect in the landscape, and you're looking at it going, oh my gosh, we were so close to them, you know, and because the plane doesn't actually fly that high, so you can see them in all their glory. And you don't have a full appreciation for them until you actually fly home over the top of them. Yeah, definitely.
When you're there and you're obviously just in your own head and you're sort of looking around, obviously you can hear the wind, but are there any other sounds that you can hear when you're in Antarctica? I've always wondered this, because obviously we've seen what the landscape looks like, but are there actually any other sounds? Is it like ice cracking or anything?
There is no sound apart from us, and yeah, if there is any wind, obviously you might hear the wind, but only because it's rippling on something of ours, pretty much. But yeah, it is so silent. I mean, it's lovely, to be honest, isn't it, George? It's so quiet. And there's no smell, obviously, just us, and we were really feral. But in terms of noises, you like, interesting you mentioned that. So we were told, not by ALE actually, but by a friend who'd been before, oh, don't panic if you hear this big like booming sound, almost like a bomb's gone off or something. It's just the ice below you basically settling. And we were like, all right, okay then. And then actually, I think it was on the first or second day, George, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We were skiing along and then suddenly we heard this massive, huge, just a big boom, wasn't it? Like something had collapsed or something. And we were like, oh my God. And it's quite, really unnerving when you're skiing along, especially knowing that there's crevasses everywhere and you're hearing this huge boom. But yeah, it was the ice settling and it happens quite often. But then it did happen again a few weeks later, I think. And when we called into our safety team, they'd asked us if we'd heard it that night, the night before, and we hadn't heard anything. Apparently there'd been a massive one and it'd been reported from a few people that had been out there and we didn't hear a thing. So we must have been dead to the world.
Yeah. Well, I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
After 2 weeks of carrying 100
it's not a sort of localized noise. I mean, the horizon in Antarctica is enormous, but it's not a localized like cracking, like you're cracking a bit of ice or something. It's a proper like whoomp, like that, you know. And it's basically it's the ice sheets moving and settling. And so they're constantly moving. They move like 20 meters every year or something. But of course, they move and then they settle. They move and then they settle. So, yeah. So it happened. Yeah, twice it happened. But yeah, the second day, honestly, we were like, "Did you hear that? Did you hear that?" We're like, "Yes, I damn well heard that." That's like terrifying.
Yeah, it was a bit terrifying, was it? Because we were, fresh newbies at that point. You know, only day two.
Yeah,
it's crazy. It's sort of like listening to like historical moments in the earth. You know that there was a time where there was much more glaciers around us, that you've kind of heard something that probably no very few people have ever really heard or recorded. It's fascinating.
It's
unreal. I do have a question for you about the weather. How quickly did you get in tune with this? So myself and Gemma have great theories about the weather, but ultimately the best weather forecaster is somebody who is in it and starts watching the patterns and starts recognizing the patterns and the subtle change. How did you interpret the weather? So I know you were given a weather forecast, but you must have really become in tune with how the weather changes and how quickly it changes down there.
Yeah, I think we were, weren't we, George? I think, the first week, I'd say we had beautiful weather. I mean, it was absolutely, it was -9, which is very pretty warm for Antarctica. And we were really surprised about how warm it was. I mean, George and I got burnt in the first week, but then it changed very quickly. And we got caught out, actually, because we hadn't got our compass out and we were kind of navigating from our GPS every now and again. And we started going in circles and it was all a bit of a difficult time, and we have a little go at each other anyway, and it got really windy and cold very quickly and a huge whiteout came over. So that was the first time we'd experienced that out there, how quickly it happened and how we'd seen this huge cloud sort of build up around us, and then literally probably within 10 minutes it completely engulfed us and we were in a whiteout. It was that quick. And I think that was the fit. And then we were in a whiteout then for about 3 or 4 days, weren't we, George? It lasted quite a long time. And then suddenly it was sunny again for about another 4 days or so, 3 or 4 days. And we were having a great time. The tent was so warm. It was +20 in the tent. And we had some great days. And then suddenly it happened again. You know, we started off a great day. And then suddenly this huge cloud bank was building up again around us. You know, you could see so far because the horizon is huge. And obviously you've got a 360 as well horizon. And you could just see this cloud bank building up. And again, you know, before you knew it, halfway through the day, we were in a whiteout again. And I think we started to realise that it was kind of like, and after that second sort of period of whiteouts, we realised it was almost like a 4-day cycle of bad weather or whiteout type weather. And then 3 or 4 days of lovely blue sky sun. And then you would go back to it, and then we started to see this pattern forming, didn't we, George? And, you know, around sort of the third or fourth day when they would then start to turn, we would start to see all this cloud build up. And also on a few of the times, George, we saw sun dogs, didn't we? I don't know what their proper name is. And that the one we saw, wasn't it, the huge one that we saw the first time round? I remember it was a lovely day. We'd sat down and we were having a break. and you kind of, when you're at the back, you don't really look behind you very often. And I think I just sat down and I kind of like turned around to look behind you. And I was like, oh my God. And there was just this huge sun dog, and it literally just filled the whole sky behind us. But it was so ominous. It was like doom was coming when they charged. And then, you know, I think then that second half of the day, the cloud just built up again. And then by the end of the day, we were in another whiteout. And then we went through the cycle again of bad kind of whiteout, crappy weather. Before then we had sun again. It was really interesting, wasn't it? We kind of got into realize this cycle of weather was happening while they're out there.
It would change. So predominantly it's a southerly wind or a variation of a southerly wind. And that's when we'd have like lovely sunshine. And then when the wind would flip northerly, which is unusual for Antarctica at that time of year anyway, then we'd get the whiteout. So we spent about 50-50 in sun and whiteout for the whole expedition, which I think is that, but judging by other people's feedback, is actually quite unusual. Because it's their summer, normally it's a, you know, you have a constant headwind, which is your southerly wind, and really good weather. So I think, you know, where that change is coming from, I don't know, but there seems to, the northerly wind would bring in the cloud, and then you'd have that 4 or 5 day rotation, and then it would flip again and go back to southerly. But I tell what was very interesting at Union Glacier was the there was a bit of a stir happening at Union Glacier when we were back there after the expedition, and the lenticular cloud started forming, and it created quite a stir at Union Glacier, and they were like, there's a big storm coming in. And the next thing is JCB arrived, and they were piling more snow on the tents and things. And apparently they weren't sure how it was going to arrive, whether it was going to travel through the valley. And basically, if it travels through the valley, it's really clean and it just, you know, whooshes through and then that's it. And he said other times it comes from, I can't remember if it's an easterly or westerly direction. It kind of like changes a little bit. And it comes from a mountainous area and it causes a big rotary effect. So it pushes down from the mountains and basically churns up. So all the big tents that we're in, they're like, you know, they're like houses. You know, you can huff and puff as much as you like. They ain't falling down. They're clamshell tents. But the staff tents are just normal, small expedition tents. So this rotary wind then comes down and destroys the half the camp. And they wake up when they've got like... The tent is on their face kind of thing. Yeah, it's just a disaster zone. So it caused quite a stir. There's that lenticular cloud started forming, and then they were like, right, we've got about 12 hours before this sets in. And then people started like roping down the tents more and, you know, tightening up straps and stuff. It was really, really telling. It was lovely to see actually how they could predict that so precisely.
And the cloud formation was amazing, wasn't it? Those lenticular clouds. Well, we got a few photos of it, and it was just, you know, we don't see skies really like that here. It was just, I mean, the skies in Antarctica were amazing, weren't they, George? Most evenings, the cloud formations and things, but that particular evening that before the big storm hit, you know, I've just never seen a sky like it. It was amazing, wasn't it?
I love hearing that. So I like know what lenticular clouds are, particularly if they're, you know, near somewhere where there's an airport or some sort of activity. It's the same in the Falkland Islands. I was very lucky to work there as well. I worked there in the winter, so in the few daylight hours that would come up if there was some in the sky for observations, you know, it's really stressful. But it just goes to show you don't like everything that you talk about doing. Like you never did an expedition before, you know, you're not meteorologists, but you learn these patterns and you learn like to listen to your, you know, you learn yourself how to understand and do all of these things. And I love that so much. Gives me hope I might get down there one day.
Oh yeah, you should if you can. Honestly, just what an amazing place, really is.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just the staff members and things, you know, you just don't know. I mean, 5 years ago, as me and Bex, you know, it wasn't on our radar. Antarctica was like one of these untouchable places. Like no one gets to go unless you're a scientist, you know, and you know, you're scientists. So, you know, you probably had a bigger opportunity to go than we did, because we're, you know, explorers kind of thing. So, you know, we didn't have an excuse to go.
It's so fantastic. So
we need
so
to go fantastic. There and do a podcast. That's what we need to do, Ash.
Do you know what? Some genius got Wi-Fi at Union Glacier, so it's absolutely possible.
And there we go. We should just definitely do that. That's our pitch.
That's insane. I tried to go down there for a number of years. Every year I put an application in, and then every year I just didn't have enough experience. And then the opportunity sort of missed, and had two little babies, and it just, you know, became something that was like, right, okay, 10 years time, I'm going to get back down there at some point.
I have two questions for you. Firstly, what was the lowest temperature do you know that you recorded while you were there?
-41 at the South Pole. So when we got there, and that wasn't wind chill, that was the actual temperature, because there wasn't any wind when we got to the South Pole.
Can you describe in words what that might feel like? I mean, I can't even comprehend.
Mm. Yeah, it's probably, I wouldn't say it's an average temperature. Average temperatures are probably -25, but of course it gets colder as you climb to the pole. And so that was actual air temperature. And we didn't actually start suffering until we got on the back of their skidoo to take us back to the ALE camp at the South Pole, that we suddenly realised how cold it was with the wind. So we were very thankful that we didn't have any wind on that particular day. But I mean, you two might will be able to fathom this a lot better than we can. But apparently, so the South Pole is at 2,800 metres. So there is a little bit of altitude, but because of where it is on the globe and how close it is to space, I don't know, it's basically the air is thinner there or something. And it feels more like precisely 4,400 metres. Yeah. So yeah, there is a scientific explanation behind that, but I can't remember the actual terminology for it. But apparently, the altitude feels like 4,004.
So yeah. that is phenomenal. I've experienced 4,000 meters, and I was sick, and I wasn't doing what you were doing. Mm. It's just walking around in South America, trying myself in La Paz. That's unbelievable. I actually didn't realize that information. Mm-hmm. I presume it's something got to do with the bulge of the atmosphere or the something to do with the poles somehow distorting, you know, ever so slightly. I've so much admiration.
Yeah. Remember we've been climbing gradually. So Union Glacier's at 800 meters. And remember, we've been climbing gradually over those 52 days, 53 days. So people, last degree clients who skied the last degree in 7 days, they get some altitude sickness over the first couple of days. But of course, we've been climbing steadily for all that time. So we've been gradually getting used to it all.
Burning thousands of calories every day. So although you're going gradually, the physical and mental toll on you at that point is, I don't know, does it not balance it out somehow?
Yeah, we think we're probably burning around 8,000 calories a day, maybe more on some days, but we were only able to eat 5,500 calories. So George and I lost quite a lot of weight by the end. I think I lost 14 kilos, George lost 10. So we were the shadow of our former selves when we finished. Safe to say, it was lovely having to eat loads of food to put weight back on. But yeah, so, and I definitely felt the second half of the expedition, I definitely felt hungry every day. In the middle of the day, I would feel hungry. But I mean, the thing with the food is that you can only carry, you've got to pull everything with you. And weight is a real big, you know, thing out there, because you're having to drag everything. So we have to kind of weigh up how many calories you could take versus how heavy that would be on for each day. And I think we'd worked out we were carrying just over 1 kilo of food a day. And also you've got to be really savvy in what we take as well. So it needs to be sort of, you know, high calories, high fat, carbs, but protein, etc. But it also things freeze, and everything freezes. So we have to be careful of what we actually took as well. So we took cheese, salami, flapjacks, loads of chocolate. So we'd eat that every single day. And then as well as freeze-dried rations then, so that we'd use water to rehydrate. And so what else? We have breakfast granola and coconut powdered milk, so all really high calorie foods that were light-ish, that wouldn't freeze, and that we could tolerate as well. So obviously we needed something we were able to stand for 52, 53 days. And it did get very samey and boring, but it became, food was just fuel in the end, really, wasn't it? You know, we needed it, otherwise we wouldn't have made the expedition. So we were just, we had to eat it, basically. I was starving anyway, so I'm always hungry. But yeah.
What was your first meal when you got home then? What was the first thing that you had when you got home?
It's a great question. I was wondering.
My at the pole, my first food was an orange, because from a third of the way through, I started craving fruit and colour. Yeah. So, and really random, like fruit I don't normally eat at home, like watermelon and pineapple and stuff like that, really tropical stuff. So, yeah, I started really craving food. So it was my first, but not a meal as such, but my first bit of food was a fresh orange that this very kind lady peeled for me, put it in a bowl, took all the pith off it and everything, and gave it to me and sat and just stood with me while I ate it. Bless her. Yeah. So, and my first meal when I got home, I think it was just whatever what was in the fridge. Honestly, I was like the cookie monster, just shoving everything in my mouth. Yeah.
Mine at home, while we were away, I was really craving bacon sandwiches. And I also, in the last couple of weeks, I kept thinking I was smelling a roast chicken. I mean, I clearly wasn't smelling any roast chickens, unfortunately. But yeah, it was really strange. I literally felt like I was smelling roast chicken all the time. So I was obviously desperate for a roast dinner. But I didn't get one of those till about a week after we came back. But I really wanted fish and chips from the chip shop. So that is what I had when I got back. I think I was just craving stodge.
It's really interesting. I'm sure a nutritionist would have a take on this, because they're all vitamin C's. And yours would have salt and protein in it. And you did say that you lost 14 kilos, where you only lost 10 kilos. I'm sure there's some very logical...
That's interesting, actually.
Primal thing going on there.
But Beck's lost more than me, because she weighs more than me anyway. So there's like 20 kilos between us.
So proportionally.
So proportionally, we've probably lost about the same. But I know when I got home, it's not so bad now. I've been home 4 months. But when I got home, I messaged my partner and said, can you make sure there's watermelon and pineapple and yogurt and stuff like that? You know, just literally, I was just trying to eat a lot of that all the time, you know, and things. Just really colourful food. So I wasn't actually bothered about, you know, a bacon sandwich and stuff. And when we were back at Union Glacier as well, I was just filling my face with these blueberry pancakes and fresh fruit all the time. So, you know, whereas Bex was like piling it up, going like leaving no meat and salmon for anybody else.
I was just eating everything. It was great.
Next time you bump into a nutritionist, ask them what that's about.
I haven't thought about that. It's a good question.
Were you at any point aware of the climate change when you were down there?
In the first week, definitely. And because it was, you know, -6, -9, that first week was just astonishingly warm. And it's never felt more, you know, the Antarctica's never felt more under threat during that first week. And then the second week, we just had howling winds. And then we're like, oh, here we go, this is Antarctica. Definitely, it was definitely that first week for me, and I never thought once did I ever think I would be too hot on Antarctica. Definitely, yeah. So yeah, climate change felt very, very close then.
Yeah, the same for me. Really, it was that first week, wasn't it? It was just we never dreamt that we'd be that hot out there.
Yeah, I also think. Sorry, just sort of adding to that as well. I also think that. So each degree has its own characteristics and personalities, believe it or not. And when you're given the briefing and they go, oh, in this degree, you know, you won't have much sastrugi, in this degree you'll have big sastrugi, and et cetera, et cetera. But the common denominator is that we had quite major sastrugi in every single, like, load, big waves in the snow, basically, literally in every single degree. And for the past few years, that's been unusual. That's not normally happened. So we had a lot of duning, we had a lot of snuff snow, and we also had snow. And because normally the duning happens from Spindrift, you know, and because it's so dry there as well, and that's why it feels like sand, and they call it duning. But we actually had, when on the warmer days, in the whiteout days, they were a lot warmer, and we physically actually had snow, which isn't meant to happen on Antarctica, apparently. So basically, things just like turn to ice. Like you'd be traveling and you'd be breathing out, and your fur trim would have snow on it because you are creating humidity around your face, and therefore that's creating snow. But of course, you need humidity in the air. So Antarctica is like between 0.5 and 1% humidity. So therefore, it should be impossible to snow, shouldn't it?
Almost, yeah.
Yeah. So you need moisture. So, but on the warmer days, it actually snowed, which is really strange.
We have somebody that we've come on the podcast a couple of times. She's an expert in the Antarctic down there, scientist Dr. Ella Gilbs is what she calls herself. But she was saying that they're like trying to get rain gauges down there.
Oh.
In heavy precipitation, yeah. They think it's raining down there actually now.
Yeah, because actually there was a guy on an expedition when we were there, and he started a lot further west, I think, George, didn't he, Sam? And they were a lot further west than us to start off with, and he experienced temperatures of I think it was +2 degrees at one point, and the snow was so soft, it was horrific. And they also had sleet. I'm sure he said he had sleet, so yeah, which is, you know, unheard of. So it was very real climate change. We saw it there, very real for some parts of our expedition. Yeah.
I have one final question. I have loads of questions, but I won't ask you all of the questions I have because we'll just be here for hours. But obviously, when you were there, it was the polar day. So it's obviously 24 hours of daylight. How did you get used to that? That's quite hard in terms of sleeping. Obviously, you're tired anyway, but how did your body and your, how do you adapt to that?
You know what? I think we adapted quite well. I thought it'd be a real issue, actually. And, it didn't seem to be too bad. I mean, I slept with an eye mask on, and what George didn't mind, and now she did. But and when you would wake up, and if my eye mask has slightly slipped up, the rays of sun, it was like lasers in your eyeballs. It was, you know, so bright. And it was quite strange, though, when you'd go out to the toilet at sort of 2 or 3 in the morning, and it was like a bright summer's day outside. That was quite strange and difficult to get your head around. But I'm not a massive fan of the dark, so I quite enjoyed having that light all the time. But I suppose, you know, if it wasn't for our phones with our, you know, with the time on, we would have no idea where we were, I think, time wise. But we just stuck to a normal 24 hours because it's run on Antarctica is run on Chilean time, so we'd already been in Chile for a week. So we just stuck to that. And that kind of kept our bodies, I think, in that routine. I suppose it was just the light, in the night, in the evenings, that would be strange. But yeah, with the eye mask on, it wasn't too bad. I didn't sleep too badly, but I think George found it a bit more difficult with the sleeping, didn't you?
Yeah, I found with the eye mask, with like my face would get, like my eyes would get really hot, and then the same as Bex, it would slip, and then it'd be like I wouldn't expect it to be have slipped, and I opened my eyes, it was like lasers. So yeah, and I just thought, and I ended up like being really restless and awake through the night then, thinking, is my eye mask slipping? So I just took it off in the end, and just kind of like either pull a hat down over my eyes or just slept with my hand over my eyes or something. But I got used to it. But I have to say, I saw it as a bit of a luxury, to be fair. I mean, I know we get a little bit sort of fascinated and concerned with circadian rhythms, and you know they are, you know, very, very important, but as long as you're strict with your routine, you know, and you are absolutely knackered when you get in the tent anyway, you can't wait to sort of just zip your sleeping bag up and close your eyes, but I think I found it a bit of a luxury, because during all our training in Norway and Sweden, of course, it was come 6 p.m it's like somebody just switches the light off and the heater. So, honestly, and I mean, in Norway, in the last few weeks of training that we had up on Hardanger, we had -27 in the tent, and it was so dark and so cold and so miserable. It was, we questioned all our life choices in that week. That it was the middle week that we were out there for 3 weeks, and that middle week was absolutely Baltic. And we had ice in on the inside of our sleeping bags and stuff. That was a tough, tough week. So anything by comparison to that, I always thought to myself, well, you know, having the warmth in the tent is a luxury, you know. So it was actually quite comforting for me. So yeah, you just manage the laser in the morning, you know, as much as you can, really. So, yeah.
Some lovely framing of reference there. Just having had the worst thing, knowing what, you know, having that relative thing of, well, this is better. Like, were you ever afraid, either of you? Do you ever feel afraid?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you have the ongoing concern of crevassing and things, or breakages, you know, either of body parts or equipment, you know. So there was that ongoing concern, like every day, you know, unless you were stationary in your tent in your sleeping bag, you had that constant concern of that. But I don't think afraid of it, because we trained for most things. You know, Antarctica's got, you know, a weird ability to throw any curveball at you. But because we trained as much as we could and we were quite well rehearsed and quite slick with everything, I don't think I ever felt afraid. In Norway, I did, because it was dark, you know, and, you know, monsters come out in the dark, don't they? but yeah, and you know, I think your imagination tends to run a bit more wild in the dark, doesn't it? It produces more sort of imagination, I think. But yeah, so there wasn't a fear of getting lost or anything like that, because we had full sun and stuff. You know, Antarctica is a strange place, but it's quite forgiving because there is 24-hour sun there. Yeah, I think.
Yeah, I think maybe a couple of when we first experienced the bad whiteouts, that was quite unnerving, I think. And, you know, particularly the day where we hadn't had the compass out and we were kind of going around in circles and things, that was a bit scary, because we had the first time we'd experienced it, and it got really cold and really windy very quickly, and we weren't prepared, basically. We'd dropped the ball, and we were very lucky that nothing bad happened to us, to be honest.
Yeah.
But I think as well, though, for us, it's probably a mental state of survival not to let things, you know, that fear get to you as well. Because I suppose every day, like George said, you know, there was a constant threat of crevassing, obviously, but the cold was a big thing. You know, if we took our gloves off for longer than sort of 30 seconds, you were looking at frostbite. You know, also there's hypothermia as well. So there's always the constant threat of something going wrong and going badly wrong. But I think, you know, our mindset was on that survival mode and not trying to dwell and think about those things too much. Because, you know, if you let that creep in to your psyche over that amount of time that we're out there and being alone, I think, you know, it could really can make us go absolutely mad, you know, or be a quivering wreck. So I think in terms of that as well, maybe we kind of just blocked out many fears probably that people may have usually had. If we thought too much about all of the things that could happen to us on a daily basis, I'm not sure we would have got out of the tent most days. But
certainly wouldn't have made it through 4 years to.
No, that's it.
Well, we are very glad that you did. And we must move on because we're running out of time and we still have a couple of more personal questions we'd like to ask you. But first of all, what is your next challenge?
Oh, Bex, this one's your fault.
Right. So we are hoping to run 7 marathons over 7 continents in 7 days. So it's called the 777. I think it's, so it's going to be, and we're going to do it in fire gear because we want to be visible. So I think we need to stand out from the crowd and continue our goal of trying to, you know, inspire women and keep visibility for female firefighters as well. So we're making it that much harder as well for ourselves. So I think the hardest thing will be the recovery. You know, our recovery will be on a plane flying to the next place. So you can imagine going on a plane when we've just run a marathon, trying to recover and then get up and move the next day is going to be the issue. Getting us onto the start line, because we're going to be very stiff and sore. But yeah, so we're really, you know, we're really excited about that. And the first marathon is back in Antarctica. So that's really cool that we'll get to visit there, albeit very, very brief. But at least we'll get to visit it as well. Yeah, again. So
I have zero doubts that you guys will just do nothing but smash it. Absolutely smash it.
I just smash something. Probably my pelvis.
No. You carried 100 kilos for 52 days. You can run. Definitely. All right, Gemma, do you want to move on to our get to know me round?
Yep. So these are just a couple of random questions. There's a couple of weather related, but most of them would say they're very, very random. Firstly, what's your favourite season?
Oh, the summer for me.
Autumn. Because of the colours.
You don't actually get many summers. I always find that interesting. Most people love the transition, either the spring transition or the autumn, or the autumn transition. So you are unique there, Bex.
Oh, wow. It's because I love the beach and I love the sea, you see. So a lot of time it's a bit nippier any other time around the summer.
Yeah.
I'm surprised, considering you both went to Antarctica, that neither of you said the winter.
That's true, actually, yeah.
I have to say,
because we have Welsh... Oh, sorry, that's because we have Welsh winters, which is basically sideways rain and wind, so...
Yeah. Although, in the summer, when it's too warm, I tend to hibernate. I'm the opposite hibernator. I'm like sat in the house, and I'll go out in the morning and come out in the evening. So if it's too warm, it's weird. I'll go for a run in the sun, no problem in the heat and everything. But sitting in it, I'm like a dog in a hot car. I can't cope. And but I do. I actually love our four seasons that we have in the UK. So I couldn't live in a country that doesn't have, you know, the seasons.
Long may they last.
Yeah,
being increasingly blended.
Sometimes you get all four seasons in one day.
Indeed. Well, you certainly do in Wales, as I did growing up as well. Yeah. It's like, oh, well, you.
I saw on Instagram today, somebody posted going, I know why the month of May is called May. It's because it may rain, it may be sunny, it may be windy, it may be this, it may be that.
If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
Oof. Invisibility, I think.
Why?
Well, I think I could just... I could go about my business, no one would see me, and I could, you know, be nosy around other people, what people are up to and stuff. And it'd just be quite interesting. It's amazing. Yeah, it'd just be quite interesting.
Probably something like really like the ability to manipulate somebody's decision making or something random like that.
I mean, like, that's a great idea.
Yeah. Yeah, it's probably one of those things that people want but don't want to admit to.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, mind control or something, yeah.
Get poor Bex to do off. Something else off. Yeah. Yeah.
He's already doing it now, mind control. That's why I ended up in Antarctica.
This is probably one of our most random questions. If you were a fruit or vegetable, what would you be?
I'd probably be a banana. Yeah. Because it's a useful fruit, I think. I think I'd always want to be useful. I find it a very utility fruit kind of thing. It's easily packed, comes in its own packaging, so you don't have to worry. You know, it's just not like an apple. And it's not messy like an orange that also comes in its own wrapping. It's got lots of potassium in it, and it's full of energy. So I'd have to be something functional. Beat that, Snips.
Oh, well, I doubt I'll be that, but I'd probably be a lemon because a lot of them are grown in nice warm countries.
Really?
Yeah, and they're sharp as well, aren't they? You know, and I'm a sharp cookie.
Yeah. Interestingly, I do love bananas as well. The only thing that bugs me when you chuck them in your bag, if you don't have them on the top, they get bruised. But they are literally the most versatile best fruit. In the world, I live off.
Yeah. You can have them with yogurt. You can have them on their own. Yeah. You can have it with peanut butter. You can have it with Nutella and peanut butter.
We found your new job is advertising and marketing bananas. There
bananas.
You go.
And then I have a lemon in the morning with hot water when I'm feeling good. So it does wake you up. It's sharp.
That's true. And also, a lot of alcoholic drinks, you put a lemon in.
Most importantly.
Okay, so two more questions. If you can invite one person to dinner, and it can be anybody at all from any historical time frame or even a fictional character, who would it be?
Gosh, that's tricky. Well, I think I'd need hours to think about this, but for now I'd say Michelle Obama, because I did read her book, or sorry, listen to her book on our expedition, and she's a pretty cool lady, has done a lot of stuff in her life, and also she's been in a lot of cool rooms with very interesting people, and I'm sure she has got a lot of goss and interesting things to say about people. So, be Michelle Obama for me, I think.
I think can I go with one alive and one dead?
Yeah, it can be from any time frame, okay. Anywhere, fictional, so, otherwise.
Okay. All right. I think from the dead era, I'd be torn between someone like Amelia Earhart or Virginia Woolf or Rosa Parks, any of those, whoever's available in their diary. I think I wouldn't be fussy with any of those three. And then for living, I'd just be really, really shallow and say Kate Blanchett.
Really?
Yeah.
You're just like a fan.
Big fan, aren't you, George?
Yeah, big fan. And it was a bit of an ongoing joke when we were on Antarctica. So I have to give you context now as quickly as I can. So there's another lady that we met when she was out there called Preet Chandy. So you might know her. Anyway, so we were told by our fixer, Steve, in the UK, that we asked, are there other women going? And he said, oh, there's so-and-so, and you. And he said, there's somebody else that I can't say who it is. And we were like, oh, I wonder who that is. So it was an ongoing joke then. It was like, oh, wouldn't it be lovely if it was like Kate Blanchett at the South Pole? And we were like, oh my God, it's Kate Blanchett and stuff. and then the next thing, so Preet was there so nobody knew that she was there at all, but she happened to be staying in our apartment, but we didn't know that she was staying there. And then so anyway, we'd had a good few days of joking how it was going to be Kate Blanchett or some massive celebrity, Michelle Obama, or some huge celebrity that was going to be on Antarctica at the same time as us. And so we walked on to reception after doing some shopping, and Preet was on reception, and the two of us went, oh, it's Preet, that's who it is. And we both went, oh, it's not Kate Blanchett. And she looked at us, and she'd never met us before, and she was like, I feel like I've disappointed you.
Yes, you have.
Yeah. I'm not Kate Blanchett. So it was an ongoing joke then that Preet Chandy was Antarctica's version of Kate. Of Kate Blanchett. So it was an ongoing joke.
You're going to meet her. I know you are. I'm going to put it out into the universe as well, but I feel like your paths are definitely going to cross. I am, and Michelle Obama is definitely on my list as well. My God, I just so inspired by her.
She's an amazing woman.
So we always like to end our podcast by asking our guests, what's one thing that you wish everybody knew, and in this case, what's one thing you wish everybody knew about being a firefighter, but also Antarctica?
I wish everyone knew about Antarctica is that there are no polar bears there. Because the amount of times we have been asked, did you see any polar bears? I said, no, they are in the north.
Good point, actually. The one thing I wish everybody knew about Antarctica was it's probably animals again, is that where we were, there were no animals. There's no liquid water where we were at Union Glacier, so therefore no life, not a fly, nothing. So I was mesmerized by that because it had never occurred to me that there's no liquid water there, so therefore nothing lives there.
Why is Union Glacier there then? What's the significance of it?
It's the runway, basically. It's a unique set of geographical and geological features that you can land large planes on this icy runway, basically.
Blue ice runway, they call it.
I never knew that. I love that piece of information.
Yeah.
Yeah. one thing I wish everybody knew about the fire service is that the women do exactly the same job as the men, and we do exactly the same fitness test standards as the men, because we are asked that quite often. Oh, do the women do the same as the men, or is the fitness test the same for you as it was for the men? So yeah.
I think the one thing I wish that everybody knew about the fire service is that not every fire station has poles that can slide down. And yeah, I can't tell you how many people have asked me, do you have a pole? And I'm like, no, my fire station is a bungalow, and as are most fire stations these days. There aren't actually many fire stations left now that have poles, and the ones that do are really big and terrifying.
Yeah, my old station.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, my old station actually. This I think there's only is mainly London. There's a few in Wales, isn't there? But it's mainly London now because they're the taller buildings because of there's not much room to build to have buildings. But yeah, my old station in I used to be at Paddington Station, and they had poles, and it was 3 floors high, and that was scary. It was scary to begin with. Yeah,
don't let go.
Literally, yeah. People have broken their feet landing badly and broken their ankles.
Yeah, and burn your hands as well. So if you've just gone to the toilet, washed your hands, and you go on the pole with wet hands, you can hear them coming down. It's like squealing all the way down, and they'll have very red raw hands by the time they get to the bottom. Yeah, they're quite nasty things actually. If you can possibly avoid using one, do.
I actually don't know how they still have poles at fire stations, considering all the health and safety these days.
And you would know.
You're just throwing yourself out of this little, you're just stepping off something and flying down a thin little pole with nothing around you.
Yeah. I think it might be Manchester, but they've got the highest pole drop in the country, and it's close to what yours was. I think it's like 4 or 5 floors or something, and there'd be people like deploying, you know, at floor on floor on floor, and you have to like, you know, shout down, you know, coming, you know, and stuff. Yeah, people deploying out onto this pole kind of thing. Yeah, you can imagine going from the 5th floor. It's terrifying.
Just picking everyone out.
Yeah.
The poles sound more dangerous than Antarctica does.
I think they are, you know.
To both of you, thank you so much for giving us your time tonight, and actually a rather good portion of your time tonight. So hopefully at some point in the future, we can somehow bring this forward back. And we are so grateful for everything that you've done, for speaking to us tonight. And we are so excited to follow your next adventure. And yeah, thank you. And thank you to all the future little girls that might, you know, just hear your story and be like, oh, I'm going to do that. And it won't be a question of, oh, you know, female or male. It'll be like, oh, I'm just going to do that. You know, it's pretty awesome what you're doing.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks.
If you have enjoyed this podcast, we would love it if you would subscribe, rate and review and share it with lots of people so we can spread our message with everybody. If people want to follow you, George and Bex, where can they follow you on social media?
We're on all the usual ones apart from TikTok. Can't get our heads around that one. And but if they go to our website, and it's just www.antarcticfirerangers.co.uk, and all our social media links are on there as well.
Brilliant. And if it's still available on ITVX, you should definitely watch the Fire and Ice documentary about their expedition in Antarctica. It was a great, great watch. So you definitely watch that. And if you'd like to follow us on Instagram, we are For the Love of Weather on X, formerly Twitter. We are the number 4 Love of Weather, and we just hope that you leave this episode loving the weather just that little bit more.
Thanks for listening. Bye.